Why can't we tickle ourselves? What makes our fingers so sensitive to shapes and textures of the objects we encounter? Why does mint taste cool to everyone all over the world? We'll get the answers to these questions and more as we talk about the science of touch. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk about how we feel and why we feel, literally and figuratively, as we talk with the author of Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And we will welcome any questions you might have as we talk about the science and the importance of touch. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. David J. Linden is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He is the author of several books, most recently Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So how important is touch to our emotional and social development?
Well, it's extraordinarily important early in life. We know that if you're born blind, you can grow up and have a fine mind and a fine body and everything's okay, and the same if you're born deaf. But if you grow up with a sense of touch, but you don't receive loving touch as an infant and toddler, then a whole host of disastrous consequences will befall you. And we know this most pointedly from the orphanages in Romania in the 1980s and 90s under the Ceausescu regime and what followed, where there were just not enough caregivers to interact with the babies and toddlers. And what happened is that these kids developed compulsive, self-soothing rocking motions. They have attachment disorders, cognitive delays, and not just mental problems. They had slowed growth rate and problems with the development of both the immune system and the digestive system. And if they didn't receive loving touch on the order of half an hour a day up until they were 2 years old, then these problems became permanent and would be there throughout their adult lives.
Do we know why this is? Why the lack of loving touch would result in such calamity?
Well, in a detailed sense, no, we don't. In other words, I would love to be able to tell you, well, when you receive loving touch, it sends signals here, and there's this biochemical signal and that biochemical signal, and that's what you need to develop normally. And actually, we don't have sufficient understanding of that. What we do know from analogous studies in rats, and rat mothers lick and groom their pups, which is more or less the equivalent of what human mothers and fathers would do with their newborns. And we know that when rat pups are deprived of licking and grooming, there are changes in what we call epigenetics. That is to say, the genetic code itself, the sequence in the DNA is not altered, but the patterns of gene expression, what genes are turned off and turned on in various cells, has changed. And this results in a situation in which these animals grow up to have more anxiety, they have higher stress hormone levels, they're more fearful of exploration of novel territories or trying new foods, and but that is about the level of understanding that we have of the biochemical pathways between loving touch and proper development. I think what's interesting is that while vision and smell and hearing are all optional for human development, loving touch is not.
Yeah. And many schools have policies against touch of any kind between students and adults, teachers, coaches, others supervising them. You suggest that these touch-phobic environments might be a bad thing.
Well, I think they're a very bad thing because, you know, to be clear, having no-touch policies for children and coaches comes out of a real problem, which is sexual abuse. And so you can understand the very real motivations for having these policies. But the problem is that abusers don't abide by these policies anyway. And so the ultimate effect is that the kind of touch that you would want to have, a teacher being able to give a hug and comfort a crying six-year-old, a coach being able to give an encouraging, you know, pat on the back to an athlete who's done a good job, these things don't happen. And there's a price to pay for that, because these interpersonal touches are what develop bonds between people. And basically they develop bonds of trust and cooperation. They forge people in the community and in the workplace and in the family and in couples into units who understand that the other is not a threat.
Yeah, I don't think you wrote about this, and I don't mean to throw you a curveball, but I'm wondering if you can address the issue of why is a loving hug from a friend or my mom welcome and that warms my heart. But, for example, Vice President Joe Biden gets into hot water when he, you know, gives a woman a shoulder rub, maybe considered inappropriately at a press conference.
Well, right. So context is everything in perception, not just in touch, but in all of our senses. Let me tell you about a cartoon that I love. There's a man and a woman sitting in a car. The man's driving. The woman has a bag of groceries on her lap. The man says, "P.U., what smells like farts in here?" And the woman says, "That is the expensive French cheese we just bought." And the man says, "Well, oh, in that case, what smells so delicious in here?" And, well, you know, it's a good joke, but it brings up this very fundamental issue in sensory biology, which is our reactions to things aren't just based on the physical parameters of what's stimulating our senses. They're also based on context. So in your example of your friend versus Joe Biden and welcome and unwelcome touching, what we have to realize is that the parts of the brain that process both the facts of touch, where on my body am I being touched, in what nature and how strongly, and another part of the brain that processes the emotional aspects of touch, is this something pleasurable or unpleasurable? These areas of the brain receive messages from higher areas of the brains that process social context. And so imagine this. Imagine your sweetheart is giving you a nice caress on the arm in a very loving, connected time, and it feels real good. And then imagine your same sweetheart giving the exact same caress, the exact same way, the same speed, same pressure, same location, but in the middle of an unresolved argument. Mm-hmm. It's not just that these things feel the same, but upon reflection you think about them differently. They actually feel different in the moment. And that is because these higher brain areas are sending messages to these touch centers and changing their activity and therefore changing your perception.
So it's interesting. Can you give us just the short course on how touch works? How does our brain perceive it?
Absolutely. So if you looked in the skin, you would see many, many different nerve endings that are specialized. So there's one that's specialized for hot, one for cold, one for pain, actually several for pain, one for itch, maybe more than that once we know. There are ones for different aspects of mechanical touch. So there's one for fine tactile form and texture, like what you would need to read Braille dots. There's one for high-frequency vibration. There's one for skin stretching. There's one for microscopic slip between your skin and objects. And all of these very specialized parallel streams of information go to your brain, ultimately, through your spinal cord, usually. And they segregate into two different kinds of processing that I just mentioned, one of them being what we call the discriminative center, all about the facts. You know, where, how intensely, and of what quality. And then the second one being the emotional tone. And this emotional touch center, which is in a brain region called the posterior insula, is what makes a caress feel good. It's what makes an orgasm feel good. It's what makes pain feel bad. And if you have damage to that area, then very funny things happen.
We will take a short pause and welcome your calls for our guest neuroscientist, David Linden, a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, author of Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And we are talking about the science of touch and how we feel and why we feel. And we welcome your input at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Have any questions about our sense of touch, the science of touch? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are talking with David Linden, who is the author of Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And we have Chris in Wisconsin Dells joining us first. Hello, Chris.
Hi,
you're on the air.
I have some very weird things going on. I have both fibromyalgia and MS. And so while I'm in horrible all-over body pain all the time, I have really bad neuropathy, and so I can't feel my surface skin. And my question for the doctor is, why is this going on? Because it's pretty irritating.
And I imagine. I'm so sorry, Chris. Well, can you address that one, David Linden?
Well, first of all, I'm very sorry as well, but I'm sorry, I can't offer medical advice over the radio. First of all, I'm not an MD, and second of all, I can't examine you.
Right, and our guest is a professor of neuroscience, but can you explain what's happening in terms of the pain she is feeling, someone who has fibromyalgia, or why is she sensing the pain from that?
Well, there would be different answers depending on the details. So I'm sorry, I don't mean to be evasive, but I can't answer that question.
Can you answer why some of us have a different threshold of pain than others, or at least we hear that? You know, some people say, I have a high threshold for pain. And, I mean, do we feel pain differently depending on the individual?
Well, yes, that seems to be the case. We know this from our daily lives, and we know that in different studies that people can, if you get a bunch of people in the lab, they will have very different pain thresholds. Now, the interesting thing is that there's a couple of different issues here. One of them is that the same person can have very different pain thresholds in different circumstances. So, for example, in combat, soldiers are often grievously wounded and don't even notice their pain at all in the heat of combat. But then later, when they're in the field hospital, then all the pain sensation comes back. There was an example of an Army medic named Dwayne Turner, who was fighting in Iraq with his unit, and he came under attack. A grenade came over the wall. He took fragments in his body. He ran out 12 times to pull his comrades to safety. In the process, he was shot twice. He never noticed either the fragments or the shots, and his buddies said, hey, Dwayne, you've been hit. Your blood's coming out. And he said, no, that's just the blood that got on me from some other guy. And they said, no, that's you. Mm-hmm. And he didn't even notice. And yet, 3 days later in the field hospital, when someone bungles the blood draw and there's, a little bit of pain from that, he complains just like anyone else. So we can have our perception of pain both modulated up and modulated down by circumstance. In terms of modulated up, I remember when I was a little kid and I would dread injections and I would go to the doctor's office. And, of course, the pain of an injection is really pretty mild. Nonetheless, you get so keyed up and you're so laser-focused on it that it feels terribly painful when it happens. So there's that within an individual. Then between individuals, there we know less. There may well be genetic variation that underlies difference in pain threshold. So there are particular genes that encode for proteins that are involved, that are found, for example, in the pain-sensing nerve endings. And it may be that genetic variation in these genes, which have names like TRPV1, contributes to the variation in pain threshold. But right now, we don't actually have, that's theoretically possible, but we don't have evidence for it.
Yeah. And why talk a little bit more about the science of pain. What is happening in the brain when we perceive pain?
Well, so this is a really interesting thing. So remember, we were talking earlier about the two different touch areas of brain, the emotional one mm-hmm. in the posterior insula and the one about the facts in an area called the somatosensory cortex. So if you have damage to the posterior insula, and then I were to whack you on the thumb with a hammer, instead of saying, ow, oh, that's terrible, ow, that hurts, the way someone would normally, you would say, yes, that's painful, it's on my thumb, now it's throbbing.
Mm-hmm.
Your voice would be very flat, you would have no affect. This pain, you would be able to recognize it, but it would have no emotional resonance whatsoever. And this condition is called pain asymbolia. Now, if you have the converse damage, if you have damage to your primary somatosensory cortex without damage to the emotional pain centers, and then I hit you on the thumb with a hammer, you would say, oh, that's terrible. And I would say, oh, I'm so sorry. Where on your body does it hurt? And you would say, I've got no idea.
Interesting. Is there a genetic component to how sensitive our perception of touch is?
Well, it's really that's a great question. And the answer is we don't entirely know. So I'll give you one example where it is for kind of a trivial reason. It turns out that, like on your fingertips, you have a fine touch sensor called a Merkel ending. And this nerve ending is what's good at, like, feeling the ridges on the edges of a dime, for example, or reading braille dots or other very fine tactile discrimination of a fine form. And there are a fixed number of these nerve endings on your finger pad. So if you have big fingers, then these nerve endings will have bigger spaces in between, and that will reduce somewhat your fine tactile perception. And if you have smaller fingers, they'll be spaced closer together, and that will improve slightly your fine tactile perception. And because finger size is heritable, that's a way in which there is a genetic inheritable component to touch perception. Interestingly, this led people astray a bit in terms of differences between men and women, because on average, men have bigger fingertips than women do. And people said, oh, you get 1,000 women in the lab and 1,000 men in the lab, on average, the women do better than the men at fine tactile discrimination on the fingertip. Maybe it's because their skin is softer and indents a little easier, and that makes it better. No, that's not the reason. The reason is just because, on average, they got smaller fingertips. And so the women who happen to have largest fingertips do about as well as the average man. And men who happen to have unusually tiny fingertips do about as well as the average woman. So it correlates with male and female, but it actually has nothing directly to do with it.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with David Linden. He is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He is author of Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And we are talking about the science of touch. Our next caller is Jenny in Delafield. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, good morning. I was always curious about why it feels very good to have somebody else touch you, but when you touch yourself, it doesn't feel the same. And I'll give an example of a foot massage. My husband will sometimes massage my feet, and it feels wonderful. When I try to do it myself, it doesn't feel the same.
That's a good one.
Thank you.
This is a great question, and it's actually related to the question mentioned earlier of why is it you can't tickle yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is the same for both, and that is our brains are hardwired to disregard the sensory consequences of our own movements. So think about this. When you're walking down the street, you don't really notice the movement of your clothes against your body. Even though if you were standing still and then you had that same sensation on your skin, you would attend to it rather strongly. And the reason is this. So let's say you go to rub your own foot or tickle your own tummy. In order to do that, your brain is sending electrical messages to the muscles in your arm and in your fingers to do those motions. But a copy of those electrical signals is also going to a brain region called the cerebellum. And the cerebellum is turning them into inhibitory signals and then sending those signals onward to the part of your body that's involved in touch sensation, the primary somatosensory cortex, and it is damping down the sensation. And so as a consequence, someone else can tickle you, but you can't tickle yourself. As a consequence, someone else giving you a foot rub feels a whole lot better than you giving a foot rub to yourself. In both cases, it's because we're hardwired to attend more to the external world than to sensations that we generate ourselves.
Well, one of the other questions I posed at the very start was, and we touched a little bit on it, but what makes our fingers so sensitive to the shapes and textures of objects that we encounter?
That's a great question. So I mentioned earlier there's this ending called a Merkle ending. And Merkle endings are particularly good at detecting fine spatial form, and they're present at high density in certain places on your body. There's lots of them on your fingertips. There's lots of them on your lips. There's plenty of them on your tongue. Not so many on the small of your back, for example. So you can detect, you can read Braille, for example, with your fingertips or, if necessary, with your lips or your tongue, but not with the small of your back. Now, there are other parts of your body that you might think of as being very sensitive, like, for example, the cornea of your eye or the hairless part of the skin of the genitals. Both of these areas can detect very tiny indentations of the skin. Nonetheless, they don't have Merkle endings. So they are sensitive, but they are not able to discriminate fine spatial form. So if you try to read Braille with either your genitals or the cornea of your eye, it will fail.
I won't do that then.
Don't go down to the base camp. You'll get arrested.
The other question I posed at the top, and let's cover that one too. Why does mint taste cool to everybody?
Well, so I think the important thing to realize is it doesn't just taste cool, it even feels cool.
That's
so if you rub mint leaves on your arm, it will feel cool there. And if you rub chili peppers on your arm, it will feel hot. So we think of like chili pepper and mint as being taste sensations, but actually they're touch sensations. They just happen to be touch sensations that are present in your oral cavity as well as other places on your skin. So the reason is this. We have nerve endings that are specialized for detecting heat, and they have a heat sensor in it called TRPV1. And we have other nerve endings that have that are sensitive for cool, and they have a sensor called TRPM8. Well, it turns out that menthol, the active ingredient in mint, the chemical that makes mint feel cool, artificially activates TRPM8. And capsaicin, the chemical that makes chili peppers taste hot, artificially activates TRPV1. And we think that the reason that this happens is because plants evolved capsaicin and menthol as ways to avoid being eaten. Interestingly, you know how people put chili peppers in their bird feeder to deter the squirrels?
I didn't know that. I'll have to try it, or should I?
Yeah, it works really well. And part of the reason it works really well is because it turns out that birds don't have a functional TRPV1 gene. They don't have the chili pepper receptor that that mammals have.
Interesting. Well, we have other callers and Facebook comments. John in Green Bay wants to know why he wants to say, actually, that he has never been able to touch the soft, fuzzy, felty surface of a jewelry box. Why would he not really be able to feel that particular, I guess, texture, but apparently can feel other textures?
Well, that is completely weird. I have no explanation for that whatsoever, actually. I wonder if that's what he means, or if he means he just finds he really dislikes it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I will just...
Right, if it means he dislikes it, that's an easier thing to understand, because people do become, can become averse to certain textures.
Yeah, what's
that seems to be something that is not heritable, but for some reason happens as a result of people's individual experience. But I cannot come up with a biological explanation for why he would be able to not be able to sense the texture of the felt in a jewelry box, but could sense, say, for example, sandpaper or braille dots.
Okay, so there would be no explanation for that. Let's take another call. Sarah in Brookfield. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. Hey, I have two questions, and I'm driving, so I'll say them quick, and then I'll get off the air. My first question is why I am actually extremely sensitive to touch. My example is I can't stand getting a massage. I'm like a cat. I can only take it for a couple of seconds, and then I'm like ready to, you know, bite someone for touching me. And then my second question is, you talked about two types of processing of touch, and I'm wondering if a traumatic event, for example, unfortunately, like a rape, would forever affect the processing. So if a woman might never feel, you know, a positive feeling towards, should be a good feeling. And I'll take my answers off the air.
All right. Professor Linden?
Okay. Well, those are great questions. And let me answer the second one first. Yes, we know that traumatic touch experience, like rape, like torture, can alter touch perception. In particular, they can alter the emotional touch area and can make what would normally be pleasurable touches feel bad. The good news is that that through therapy, both psychotherapy and therapy in which you sort of desensitize yourself to this previous issue, usually this can be reversed with a lot of care. Another thing that should be noted is that there can be a sort of a positive feedback system between anxiety and the emotional aspects of touch. You know, a lot of people, for example, who suffer chronic pain are always worried, when will my pain come back? Will it get worse? When will it happen again? Which, of course, makes the anxiety worse, which makes the pain worse. And this is very similar in a post-traumatic situation. And the good news is that this positive feedback loop can be broken not just by anti-anxiety drugs like benzodiazepines, but also by behavioral practices to reduce anxiety, like exercise and meditation and mindfulness training and even prayer for some folks. So that's the good news about that aspect. Now, the issue of why is it that some folks, like our caller, are averse to certain kinds of touch, like massage, that's a great question. In most cases, this cannot be traced to something that's heritable or genetic. But what I should say is that we actually know extraordinarily little about genetics of touch. Let me give an example. Lots of people hate cilantro, and some people like cilantro.
Mm-hmm.
We now know that all the cilantro haters carry a mutation in one particular odorant receptor in the nose. There are about 400 odorant receptors in the human nose, and if you have a mutation in one particular one, then you will be a cilantro hater. It's very likely that there's going to be something analogous for touch sensation, that these molecules that are involved in the nerve endings that have touch will have variant forms. And some of those variant forms will make people like or dislike particular, or be sensitive or insensitive to particular aspects of touch or hot and cold or heat or pain or what have you. But right now we just don't know enough about it to really make that case. Now, there are some particular examples. For example, it is well known that people who are on the autism spectrum are often very averse to interpersonal touch, except for very hard squeezing. And if you just look at the structure of the nerve endings in the skin of people on the autism spectrum, you can't see any obvious differences. But there may be differences that can only be detected biochemically, and it may be that the differences are in the brain rather than in the skin.
Our caller mentioned that she would be like a cat and bite someone if they touched her too long. And that did make me think about cats, how they will purr and love you to pet them just for a little bit, and then they'll bite you when they've had too much. And I heard it is they have some sort of, you know, like electricity going through them, and it's just not pleasurable after a while. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I don't know that much about cats in particular. In truth, very little touch research is done in the laboratory on cats at this particular time. But what we do know is, I think everyone has the experience that if you pet a cat or a dog with the grain of their fur, they're much more likely to like it than if you pet against them. It's the same with us humans, with our arm hair, right?
Right.
And so there's a directionality to it. And if you looked in that hairy skin under the microscope, what you would see is that there are nerve endings that wrap around the base of hair follicles and sense hair deflection or hair pulling. And some of those nerve endings have kind of a half moon shape. And that half moon shape confers upon them the ability to sense the difference between deflection with the grain of the hair and against the grain of the hair. So those signals are what allow you to discriminate that kind of touch and probably determine the probability of that cat biting you after a while.
We are talking about our sense of touch and the science. What's going on with our sense of touch? And we'll continue after this break. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with a guest neuroscientist about the science of our sense of touch. David Linden is the author of Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Next, we go to Tom in Leona. Hi, Tom.
Yes, hello. Your speaker had been talking about the Merkel endings in fingertips. And my question is, if someone sustains damage to their nerve endings due to like a disc herniation or other injury, and those nerve endings in the fingertips are also subsequently damaged, will they eventually recover, or does the person possibly retain numbness that would last for a lifetime? Thank you.
So that's a great question. So the good news is that nerves in the periphery, that is to say the nerves that course throughout your body outside of the brain and the spinal cord, do have some capacity for regeneration. And that capacity is greater early in life than it is later in life. So depending on the details of the injury, if you sustain damage, if you get nerve damage in your wrist or your arm or your hand, the chance that you will get some sensation back is pretty good, particularly if you're young. But it's not guaranteed. A lot of it depends upon the mechanical details of the way that the nerve was damaged, whether it was sliced or crushed, or whether an entire segment was lost or was a tiny little nick. I think there's bad news here, and the bad news is that all of us have the most number of touch-sensitive nerve endings at about age 20, and every year thereafter, we lose about 1% of these nerve endings, and we lose all the different kinds of nerve endings, so the ones for heat and cold and pain and itch and sexual sensation and fine touch discrimination, they all go down about 1% a year. When you're young, you don't notice it, and when you're middle-aged, you don't even notice it. But by the time you're old, you've lost a whole lot of these touch receptors, and it gets to be a problem. So this is one of the reasons why old folks who are confined to bed often get terrible bed sores, and you would think, oh, my God, that's so painful. Why don't they just report it right away? Sometimes it can get very bad. Well, the reason is because they've lost a lot of their nerve endings that sense pain. Another issue is that you lose the nerve endings in the soles of your feet, and those nerve endings in the soles of your feet are very good at sensing the ground underneath your feet, and you use them to adjust your stance properly. And so this is one of the contributing factors to the prevalence of devastating falls in old folks, other factors being muscle weakness and balance problems.
What can you explain phantom pain, the perception of pain in a limb, for example, that's been amputated?
Yes. Well, phantom pain is still not entirely understood. So the whole idea is when you have a limb that's been amputated, most folks have a sensation that the limb is still there. And that is because the brain is trying to make sense out of the now very disparate neural signals that are coming from the stump and from the surrounding area. And it's trying to make an inference that the limb is still there that isn't really true. The problem with phantom pain is that the way it was done in the old days is if you were having an amputation, you'd have a general anesthetic, but not a local. And when that happens, what that means is the pain signals are getting from your limb to the spinal cord, but then they're blocked before they get to the brain. The problem with that is that the very intense pain signals from the amputation, as they reach the spinal cord during the surgery, produce changes in the spinal cord that are long-term, kind of the same way our experience in the world changes our brain to encode memory. This intense pain changes the electrical properties of the connections between neurons in the spinal cord to produce chronic phantom limb pain. And what we now know is that it's a better practice to give both a local and a general anesthetic, and that this reduces but does not eliminate the incidence of phantom limb pain.
Randy in Appleton is with us. Hi, Randy. What's your question?
Hi, I've noticed over the last few years a surge in pain clinics popping up. At least they're advertising a lot more. I'm wondering, how are they treating pain, and do you recommend any of these pain clinics?
Well, you know, I can't. I don't know anything about any particular pain clinic, so I can't speak in generalities or endorse anything. What I can tell you is that there's a lot of variation. Some pain clinics are basically just there to give you opiates, and some of them do a very good job at that, and some of them are a little bit dubious and are basically a front for giving opiates to people who don't really need them. There are also pain clinics who are really good at considering non-opiate alternatives for pain management, and even some of the behavioral practices that I mentioned earlier, like exercise, meditation, and mindfulness, which can be useful so also for chronic pain. So I would say there's no generality. There are certainly some pain clinics that can do a lot of good, and there are some that can do less good, and there's some that can actually be harmful.
Yeah, I think Randy he's gone now, but he wanted to talk more of like infrared or laser and that kind of stuff. But maybe you can just tell us how painkillers block pain?
Well, so there are different kinds of painkillers. So, you know, the problem is that they're not that good. In other words, we have drugs that are very good at blunting pain but have terrible side effects, like opiates are really good painkillers. They're extraordinarily effective, but they're addictive, and they produce euphoria, and they make you constipated. So, you know, they've got a lot of problems associated with them as well. So the opiate class of painkiller activates an opiate receptor both in the brain and the spinal cord that mostly blunts the emotional pain circuit, although it also slightly blunts the discriminative pain circuit as well. And it acts at several different places, the brainstem, the spinal cord, and the cortex, where it works. There are also drugs like the anti-inflammatory drugs like aspirin and ibuprofen and acetaminophen. Those kinds of drugs are work by reducing the production of chemicals called prostaglandins and leukotrienes that are part of the inflammatory cascade. So when you have tissue damage, then you recruit a kind of blood cell called a mast cell, which secretes histamine and which produces an inflammatory cascade, and that inflammatory cascade produces lingering pain. Now, that lingering pain can be good. In other words, if you injure a joint, for example, you don't want to put your full weight on it. You want to favor it in order to recover. So that lingering pain can be serving a good purpose. Nonetheless, if you interfere with that inflammatory cascade, then you can reduce pain, and that's what these anti-inflammatory drugs do. Interestingly, there are also anti-anxiety drugs can be good for pain because they can break the feedback loop between anxiety and chronic pain as well, even when they don't work on pain directly.
We have a few more minutes with our guest, David Linden. He is the author of Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And we are talking about the importance of touch. We're talking about how our brain perceives touch, and talking about our sense of touch. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And Professor Linden, we've been talking a lot about pain. We can talk a little bit about pleasure and touch. It is a family show, but maybe you can tell me why my husband thought when it was one of our first meetings and at a party, and I touched his forearm, and I said, when I said something to him, I think I was getting his attention, and he took that as a flirt, and it was very pleasurable for him. What's going on there?
Well, it turns out that we are we have dedicated caress detectors in our hairy skin. And hairy skin is like everywhere except like our lips and the palms of our hands and the soles of our feet and a couple of other places. And so we are hardwired to find certain types of interpersonal touch pleasurable. There's a special nerve ending called the C-tactile fiber. It wraps around the base of hair follicles. It senses hair deflection, and it's tuned for a particular range of caressing speed. So if you think about it, if someone goes to give you a caress on the arm and they move their hand very, very slowly, that doesn't feel good. It feels like an insect. And if they skim their hands over very, very quickly, that doesn't feel good either. There's an intermediate range of speeds, about 1 to 2 inches per second, that feels loving. And it turns out that that particular range of ideal caress is actually encoded in the properties of the C-tactile nerve fiber, meaning that if you record the electrical activity of one of these fibers while someone is getting their arm caressed, that fiber will send the most electrical signals to the brain at precisely those speeds that we find to be most pleasant.
And why do we like to hold hands with with a friend, or especially a boyfriend or a girlfriend?
Well, that's a great question. We know less about that because the palms of the hands don't have these C-tactile fibers that are the caress sensors and that also project to the emotional areas.
Uh-oh. I think we lost you for a moment. Maybe there was a call waiting situation. Professor Linden, can you finish your thought?
Can I answer again? Yeah, so it turns out that the hairless skin of the palm doesn't have the C-tactile endings, the caress detectors. And so we really don't understand the pleasurable aspects of hand-holding at a biological level.
Mm-hmm. So what are we still learning about touch, or what do we still need to learn about touch?
Well, we need to learn an enormous amount. Touch research is grossly underfunded right now. I mean, biomedical research is generally in the present administration, has been for many years. But the let me give you an example. We right now, if you go out and in your yard and you're working in your garden, you get some poison ivy and you get a terrible chronic itch for it. The kinds of creams that you can get from your dermatologist to make it better, they're not very effective, and you're going to be up all night scratching. Likewise, I mentioned that these pain drugs that we have, either they're mild ones that aren't very effective, or the ones that are very effective have bad side effects. So by understanding the molecular basis of things like itch and pain, which we are now starting to pick apart, by finding genes that are expressed and are important for the function just of itch neurons or just for pain-sensing neurons, then this will allow us to create therapies that will be much better. So 10 years from now, you're very much likely to have an anti-itch cream that really is extraordinarily effective. And 10 years from now, you're very likely to, when you go to the dentist, instead of getting an injection of xylocaine that completely numbs your face and gets rid of both the pain sensation but also all the touch sensation and also your ability to control the muscles in that area because it blocks all the nerves, instead you'll have a drug that just blocks the pain nerves. And leaves everything else intact, and it'll be a much better therapy.
Well, that's great. In our final minute, then, what would you like our listeners to take away about our conversation about touch?
I think the thing to take away about touch that's most important is that touch is an intrinsically emotional sense. And we have clues from this in our language. There's a reason why when we've been emotionally affected, we say, "I'm touched." There's a reason why our feelings are called our feelings and not our sightings and our smellings. And there's a reason why when someone's emotionally clumsy, we call them tactless. Literally, they lack touch. Touch is deeply wired into the emotional circuitry of our brain. And in terms of news that you can use, I think the most important thing is that interpersonal touch is crucial for reducing anxiety, for reducing depression, bonds of trust and cooperation with those around you, and touch is particularly people tend to touch less as they get older. So I would say keep that interpersonal touch going your whole life, and you see enormous benefits both mentally and physically.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being with us. David Linden is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, author of Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Kayla Blato and to Bill Martins for producing and directing these programs. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. We'll have two guests from different perspectives talking about the week's top news stories. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.